From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, where we're still coming to terms with a great new year, a great new decade. What are the biggest threats that America faces in this new year? Right now, the threat from Iran seems to have receded a little bit, at least in the minds of many of our leaders, leading commentators, and I think the American public. We were very, very fortunate last night. No American casualties after the promised Iranian retaliation. And it appears from the statement made by President Trump this morning that there will be no American retaliation in return for the Iranian retaliation. Or what was that about those earthquakes that took place, or the plane crash, or... Nobody better to speak to about any of this or of the real risks that America faces in 2020 than Ian Bremmer, who has just prepared a list of our risks with a couple of red herrings. In other words, things that we don't need to be that worried about. He prepared it for Time magazine. Ian Bremmer is an American political scientist. He specializes in U.S. foreign policy, states in transition, and global political risk. He's president and founder of Eurasia Group, which is a political risk research and consulting firm. Ian, thanks very much for speaking to us. Happy New Year. And what about the level of the Iran threat? You didn't put Iran on your top 10.
Well, it's funny. I mean, the report came out on Monday, and the attack, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani came out on Friday. So I had ample opportunity, and all weekend people were telling me that we were heading for World War III, and I changed my New Year's resolution. I decided that my job was going to be to try to tell people that we weren't on break. And that's really what I did. I mean, Iran is still obviously a major antagonist of the United States in the region, but Trump was not looking for war, and the asymmetry of power between the U.S. and Iran is immense. The Iranians aren't suicidal, and so I think what the problem was is, you know, we've pulled out of this nuclear deal. It hurt the Iranian economy, but Iran has no friends. So for the last year, they were really frustrated and trying to find a way to get the deal back on so their economy could do better, but no one was helping them. So then they started lashing out, and they were lashing out without the U.S. doing anything. So the Iranians had no idea what the consequences were, the red lines. They didn't know. They were in an unknown, uncharted environment, and that was even true when they hit Saudi Arabia and they took 50% of their oil offline. The Saudis were shocked by that, of course, right, because they're a big ally of the United States. Trump made that first trip outside of the U.S. to Saudi Arabia. He touched the orb. I mean, all the excitement, right? And so then they go after Americans. And Trump decides absolutely not. And so I will tell you that if Thursday the Iranians did not know what the red lines were, by Friday they did. And that changed the tune of Iran very dramatically, and they backed away. They de-escalated about as quickly and as dramatically as anyone could have imagined in the last 72 hours. And, you know, now we're back to, are we going to engage in diplomacy, or do we still have this kind of status quo?
Now, you are, when you look at the nature of their attacks last night and the missiles that they sent, they weren't rockets, they were missiles, they were fairly advanced missiles. Do you think it was incompetence, a happy accident, providential, or deliberate that they actually sent the missiles without inflicting American casualties?
Well, given that they told the Iraqi government in advance that they were doing it, their full expectation was that the Americans were going to be informed and that the U.S. would get out of harm's way. A small number of missiles at two bases in response to the Americans killing their military leader in their cabinet, most important person, were, you know, influencing their policies across the region. I mean, you don't need to be providential to understand what's going on here. I mean, this was Iran trying to do the least possible that they could announce domestically they had taken steps to respond, but that please, the U.S. would not see as requiring any kind of retaliation on their part. And they were clearly successful in getting those messages across.
No, and again, it appears to be turning out to be something that has worked out very much to the benefit of the United States of America. Do you think that with everybody talking about off-ramps, there is actually a chance that we renegotiate some kind of nuclear deal? Iran wants one very big thing, which is an end of sanctions so their economy can recover. We apparently want two things. Iran to stop sponsoring terrorism and to step down from their nuclear weapons program. And meanwhile, the Iranians want to come back and say, and we want you to leave Iraq. Now, are there any of these things at two for two that are unthinkable?
Well, leaving Iraq, frankly, is something that up until a couple days ago, Trump kind of wanted.
Yeah. Right?
Now that he might get forced, now they're saying, no, we don't want to go. We sent that letter by mistake with the Arabic translation, but it was a draft, you know, come on. But seriously, I think the real issue is that the original Iranian nuclear deal, even though it was celebrated as a massive deal, a breakthrough deal, was actually too small. It was too small for the Americans in the sense that it only covered 10 years and it didn't involve all these other problems we have with Iran. It was too small for the Iranians because it didn't actually take all the sanctions off. I mean, because the U.S. maintained a bunch of sanctions, given their support of terrorism and ballistic missiles, they weren't getting all of the investments that they thought they were going to get. And the Iranian president, the foreign minister, were taking a lot of grief at home for, well, we give away the store and what do we get for it? And that's certainly not Trump's perspective. That is the Iranian perspective. And so, you know, in order to make this work, you do need to make the deal a little bigger, a little more robust. It's got to last longer. It's got to involve more than just nuclear weapons and research. I do think the window is open for that. It's open in part because the Iranians just backed down, but it's also open because Iran is in weaker shape right now than they were when Trump became president. Their economy's taken a hit. Their military's taken a hit. Their ability to project power in the region. I mean, they've got major demonstrations inside Iran, in Iraq against Iran, in Lebanon, right? I mean, these are the countries where they have all the influence. These countries aren't doing very well. So I think that if Trump were willing to engage in creative, artful diplomacy with his allies, there's a real possibility to get a better deal done with Iran. But my God, Mike, is that a steep if for this administration?
Well, again, you're right, obviously, it would be a huge, huge challenge. It would also probably help President Trump achieve that Nobel Peace Prize that he has been lusting for. But stranger things have happened. I mean, the one thing that strikes me is one of the things that President Trump has said repeatedly in recent weeks that you know and I know and everybody knows just is not true, is that ISIS has been utterly defeated. There's no more ISIS threat. ISIS is still a threat to us, and it's still very much a threat to Iran. We have a common interest there, don't we?
We do, but here, you know, Trump has been pretty honest about this, right? I mean, you remember when the U.S., when Trump wanted to pull all the troops out of Syria, then again back down, right?
Yep.
He said, look, if ISIS escapes, they're escaping to Europe. Let them take care of it. I mean, the reality is that radical Islamic terror in the form of ISIS and al-Qaeda are much more a problem on the ground in the region than they are in the U.S. They're much more a problem on the ground in Europe.
Right.
Than they are in the U.S. And yes, the U.S. is doing the vast majority of the lifting. And, you know, Trump's interest, Trump says that, and he says that, and not just Trump, but the White House across the board says that the United States is now the world's largest producer of energy. We weren't before. Why are we paying all this attention to the Middle East? So actually, the alignment of interests on that between the U.S. and Iran is becoming lessened. And the Trump administration's unilateralism vis-a-vis its allies makes that a bit more challenging.
It also, you had mentioned, of course, the United States becoming a world's largest energy producer and a net energy exporter. This is very, very important because it makes it much more credible that we would actually strike at some of Iran's oil resources. No, if we ever did get into an escalation.
Sure. Absolutely. Though, again, I don't think you need a lot more credibility than what Trump gained on Friday.
Right.
But I think you've established effective deterrence, right?
Yes, I think Dr. Johnson says the gallows doth wonderfully concentrate the mind. And I'm sure some of the Iranian leadership must be thinking about that.
I think something that people don't want to talk about in the mainstream media is that, you know, when you are president of the world's most powerful country, you can afford to miscalculate a lot more. It turns out you're a lot more lucky than other countries, right? Because things kind of go your way. People give you space. They back down to you. Trump does miscalculate. But the Iranians don't have the luxury of being in that position. And they're highly aware of that now.
Okay. When you talk about the big risks, threats for 2020. Number one on your list that we really do need to talk about has to do with the election this November in the United States of America. And the risk, you say, is not that Trump wins re-election or that Bernie Sanders wins or that Elizabeth Warren, whoever the Democrats nominate. What you're saying is the big threat to the election is that its results are not accepted as valid and definitive. Explain that.
Yeah. The big threat is that the election kind of fails. And there are two things I would mention here. The first is we have an unprecedented situation. Trump has been impeached for abuses of power to get the Ukrainian government to investigate his principal political opponent running in 2020 and his son. In so doing, would have undermined the Democrats' election chances. He's going to be acquitted of that by the Senate in relatively short order, and then he's going to run for re-election. And clearly, Trump impeachment will no longer be effective as a brake on any actions. It will have broken effectively as a process for 2020, which means that things like McConnell feeling the need to ensure election security vis-a-vis external intervention. I've heard this from Republican and Democratic senators. They're not going to do it. In terms of disenfranchising people from the rolls in swing states, you see a lot of movement in that direction. Potential for politicized investigations against those that are winning on the Democratic side. Same thing. So that is all happening. And I think that if it turns out to be in any way a close election, you're going to see in the U.S. what you saw in the U.K. after Brexit, where the problem was not that the people voted for Brexit. The problem was that the U.K., half of the population just didn't accept it. And so for a couple of years, you had the U.K. at the expense of all other governance, just eating itself. We don't accept that outcome. What was it? It wasn't legitimate. And I think that in the United States, the potential that the losing side just says, no, we're not going to accept this. We're not going to govern. It was delegitimized, whether it's the Democrats saying it was stolen by Trump or Trump loses and he says the Ukrainians were involved in corruption and the intelligence agencies were involved in it. We're not going to accept it. I think the potential that we end up being maximally incapable of getting real governance down because our country is so divided and beside itself over the outcome of the election. And that's a real problem for us.
Let me just be very direct here. When you say it's a real problem for us, the depth of the problem, let's say President Trump wins a runs and loses, and he loses very narrowly. He loses. Yep. Maybe he even wins the popular vote and loses the Electoral College. That could happen. Does Trump, go quietly, or does he somehow barricade himself in the White House and refuse to leave office?
It's almost impossible to imagine he goes quietly.
isn't that shocking?
Calls of faith. Yeah, no, shocking. No, and it's impossible to imagine that he won't use every tool available to him to contest the outcome. I mean, certainly, you know, legal contestations, talking. I mean, he said that 2016 was rigged. He said that he has said on occasion that he has actually won the popular vote, that millions of people voted that weren't supposed to.
Yeah, he said, right? There are 3 million illegal voters, which, of course, the evidence has shown that they couldn't find 3,000. But this is...
That was an election he won, Mike.
I know. He was the sorest winner in history. We have a lot of sore losers in American history. We don't have many sore winners. This goes to... I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with the history of the election of 1876 between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Jones Tilden. And that was an election.
And Reconstruction.
Correct. And it was not accepted. They didn't even have a final result until literally the day before the inauguration. And it was a massively destructive thing for the country because people knew the election was really questionable. Tilden had won the popular vote by a very substantial margin, and then lost the election.
Yep.
But
people think about 2000 as the bad election outcome. But there, I mean, Gore and Bush sat on the sidelines while the Supreme Court decided. And then once they decided, the outcome was that. And Bush said, "Great," and Gore said, "Okay, I concede." It is hard to imagine that in this environment.
Well, you know, this is one of the reasons that it seems to me it is so out of the question to accept Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren as a nominee for president, because both of them seem to me extremely likely to protest any result in which they don't win if they're the nominees, and maybe even to refuse to accept it and to take to the streets or who knows what nonsense. That's the number one threat. What is the one threat on your list? Because a fascinating list. We've posted our website at michaelmedved.com. People can read it up there. You do talk about discontent in Latin America, and this goes beyond Venezuela.
Yes. Well, in Latin America, you have so many people that feel like the elites and the establishment are just in it only for themselves, and they're demonstrating on the streets. And while that is a problem in the wealthy countries like the U.S. and Europe, ultimately it doesn't lead to dramatic policy changes. In Latin America, it does. It has whiplashed a whole bunch of countries. In the case of Chile, the biggest demonstrations you've seen in the post-Pinochet era, and as a consequence, the leader of the country who, you know, won a billionaire business agenda, pro-markets, has thrown away his entire election platform and has to move for a new constitution, completely different orientation, because otherwise he was going to be forced out. We see some of this with President Duque in Colombia. We see with Argentina, with the election now of Fernandez and Kirchner throwing Macri out, who had been enormously popular center-right figure. You know, all of these right-wing pro-business types that had been winning in Latin America were winning mostly because they were anti-establishment types, not because people liked the orientation towards the markets and business. And that means it can change a lot. And the largest economy in South America, Latin America, is, of course, Brazil. And right now, you have another similar leader who is an anti-establishment populist but very pro-market. And you have massive economic reforms happening across the board in Brazil. He's probably the best economic reformer in the emerging markets. But he could easily turn away from that if the economy starts slowing down because the people won't support it.
Okay, these are all substantive matters on which to be concerned. Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group, thank you. Your Peace and Time magazine about the 10 biggest threats for 2020. Is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. Coming back, I want to talk about another threat, the threat that we have a repeat of the roaring 20s in a very dangerous way. That's the roaring 1920s. Coming up on The Medved Show.
Americans are going to hear the truth.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, talking with Ian Bremmer about the big threats emerging around the world. This goes together with a number of articles, and I've seen about a dozen of them so far, that talk about the new Roaring Twenties, that there is some kind of era of similarity between where the world was in the 1920s, 100 years ago, and where we are right now. By the way, I go into this in some detail in a brand new podcast in our In Light of History series that we're going to be posting tomorrow. And just one aspect of it that it seems to me is worth mentioning is that one of the areas of similarity is that in the 1920s began with Mussolini taking over in Italy, which was a relatively new country. There was no nation of Italy until 1870. And all of a sudden in 1920, they go in this crazy socialist fascist direction with Il Duce, the chief, the Italian version of the Führer, who then inspires the Führer, who then takes over Germany. Now, he didn't do it in the 1920s, but he tried in 1923, was a beer hall putsch. In any event, what happened was politics became polarized and kind of everywhere. And in the United States, the Democratic Party moved pretty directly to the left. And certainly compared to where it was in the 19th century. And this polarized politics, this idea of the center collapsing after some generations of largely centrist government, and that happening around the world, was one of the features of the 1920s, which set up, of course, the disasters of the 1930s, World War II at the end of the decade and the Depression at the beginning. And does that mean that we have that coming for us in the next decade, that the collapse of centrist government is going to continue? Well, you have something to say about that. And I do think it's one of the reasons it's important that people keep talking to each other in a more substantive way. You'll have access to our podcast about the Roaring 20s. Some people have said what we can hope for would be the Boring 20s. Wouldn't that be nice? Because when things get too exciting and too interesting, that also is usually an indication that they're dangerous. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. Chuck Todd was on NBC. He was actually not particularly impressed by President Trump's announcement today on Iran, which I think generally soothed people, reassured them that the United States was not going to become roaring back with another bold and extremely punishing move against the Iranians, given the fact that they did not inflict any casualties on our country or on our Iraqi allies with their strikes last night. What Chuck Todd didn't like, and I'm sympathetic to his concern, was the fact that President Trump used this rather triumphant occasion to attack his predecessor. Listen.
I think it is notable at how ham-handedly the president tried to politicize this by blaming the previous administration for financing. We're glossing over that. The sitting president of the United States accusing essentially the previous president of helping to finance Iranian weapons is quite remarkable that he's willing to push the envelope like that with this office. I mean, I guess at this point we shouldn't be surprised that he does these things anymore. It's still a remarkable thing that he actually did it.
What he said was, look, this is something he said during the campaign. It's not that he just discovered that he hated the Iran deal. He always hated the Iran deal. The striking thing here is that when he talks about the missiles that were struck last night, that he claims that the Iranians were using money provided to them by Barack Obama. That's probably a stretch. I would imagine the fact checkers will have some time with that. But the truth is, given the fact that he wants to negotiate a new and different deal, he does have to break with the narrative that says that, gosh, we would have all been better off if President Trump had never withdrawn from the Iran deal, and that blames President Trump for this current confrontation. Pulling out of the Iran deal was an invitation to negotiation, not for further confrontation, it seems to me. Because President Trump never said that he didn't want to have an agreement with Iran. What he has said very consistently is he does not want them and will not permit them to develop nuclear weapons. Pete Buttigieg, who is continues to be one of the front-running Democratic candidates, he's one of the people who's probably going to be there all the way to the convention. He is running particularly strongly in Iowa and New Hampshire. Mayor Pete said this about the Soleimani killing. Listen.
Now, no one ought to shed a tear for General Qasem Soleimani, who was behind attacks and destabilizing efforts across the region. If there is one thing we have learned in our modern times about U.S. involvement abroad, it's that when you don't have a plan or know what you're doing, when you act when there could have been another way, taking out a bad guy is not necessarily a good idea.
Okay, except what if it turns out, and I think this is what does appear to be turning out, that actually there was a plan. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that Pompeo and Esper and O'Brien, the president's secretary of state, his secretary of defense, and his national security advisor, they're all smart guys, and they recognized that once they take out Soleimani, the Iranians would have to do some kind of face-saving response, but that they assumed it would be precisely the kind of response it was. And then they welcomed the idea of using that moment to move us in a different direction in negotiating with the Iranians. I think if history shows that this was actually was foreseen by some of the president's advisors, it would not be unthinkable at all. Brett Baer on Fox was much more willing to give President Trump credit for the way this entire matter has been handled. Listen.
Listen, he did draw that red line. He did say, if you kill an American, we are going to strike back and strike back hard. They did. There's all this talk on Capitol Hill, and the briefing is now ongoing for House and Senate members. The Gang of Eight briefed yesterday about the imminence of this threat. You talked about it earlier as far as Soleimani and taking him out. But there is this sense that this president perhaps doesn't get credit when something goes right. Originally, as this all was happening, it was going to be World War III. He's starting World War III, and there's no strategy here. Now, we saw what Iran did in response. We see what the U.S. is saying in response to that. And you wonder whether Trump derangement syndrome factors in to some of the responses you hear publicly here in Washington.
Okay. Clearly, people tend in the United States to see everything from a political lens. There is, speaking of that, a real political news, the continued rise of Bernie Sanders. The Iranians might be encouraged by that. Why? We'll get to that coming up on the Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, Bernie Sanders, who has been among the most outspokenly critical commentators about the killing of Soleimani. And of course he would be, because he's Bernie Sanders, is the subject of a very alarming column by Jason Riley in The Wall Street Journal, who points out, well, the headline says, be prepared for President Sanders. The Vermont Socialist could soon become the front runner for the Democratic nomination, is the subhead. He says, odds are that the Vermont senator won't be the next president, but it isn't out of the question. The Real Clear Politics polling average has him leading in Iowa and New Hampshire, and less than a point out of second place in Nevada, the third contest. If he were to win a couple of these early races, he could lose the fourth one in South Carolina, where he trails badly, and still have great momentum going into Super Tuesday. That's on March 3rd. And he also just raised $34.5 million in small donations from literally millions of people around the country. He has more money than any of the Democratic candidates, except for Bloomberg and Steyer, who are spending their own money. They're not raising anything. And Jason Riley points out, 4 years ago, Mr. Sanders virtually tied Hillary Clinton in the Iowa caucuses and easily won the New Hampshire primary. On Super Tuesday in 2016, he picked up four more states: Colorado, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Vermont, of course. And he lost Massachusetts by just a whisker. This year, Michael Bloomberg will be on the Super Tuesday ballots, and whatever votes he garners likely will come at the expense of fellow moderates Joe Biden, which could help Mr. Sanders. Okay, this is all very conceivable. And then he points out this. There's a rule on the Democratic side that anybody who gets 15% of the vote gets delegates. You do. You get some delegates. And because of the Bernie bros, Bernie's diehards, his loyalists, and he has them in every state, he probably will get 15% just about everywhere, even places where he loses. Which means he's picking up votes everywhere. And does that make it unthinkable that he comes to the convention with more delegates than anybody else? It's not entirely unthinkable. It's still unlikely. I mean, after all, he's 79 years old. He's cranky all the time and shouting at you all the time about something. His folks love him. And it's something that we do have to be prepared for. And the prospect, again, and this goes back to what Ian Bremmer was saying earlier, of a Trump-Sanders election, can you imagine either one of those guys, either Trump or Sanders, saying, oh, yeah, close-fought battle. It was a tough election. It was really close. But I guess I lost. Bernie was not the most gracious loser when he lost to Hillary. Can only imagine how it would be if he were the nominee against Trump. Let's go to Steve in Tacoma. Steve, you're on the Michael Medved Show.
How you doing, Michael?
Hey, I'm doing okay.
Good. Representative Hurd said something that was actually incorrect. He said you can't hide behind a foreign country's uniform and do terrible things. You actually can. You can sanction other countries. You can provoke internal unrest. You can declare war and invade target combatants. You can't assassinate foreign politicians, no matter how terrible they are. And he was bad. I don't disagree with that.
He was in uniform. He's a military officer, and he was directing military affairs. And yes, you certainly in international law. I don't know if you heard when Alan Dershowitz, Harvard law professor, was on this show. I think it was Monday. And if you talk about international law, it was not against international law when we took down Admiral Yamamoto in Japan. Right? During World War II. We shot down his plane.
We had declared war. We had declared war.
Okay, so but America hasn't had a declared war since World War II. The last time we declared war was on December 9th, 1941. And we haven't declared war since then. We've fought very substantial wars in Korea, in Vietnam, of course, in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And the fact that we haven't declared war doesn't change the fact that if there are military operations that are being directed against us, if there are terrorists who are trying to strike us, quasi-military or paramilitary, then we have a right of self-defense. And why wouldn't that apply in the case of Soleimani?
But in the perspective from the other side, could they not justify, God forbid, attacking someone like Pompeo? I'm sure he's regarded as a terrorist within the Iranian terrible regime. But, I mean, I'm sure that they call him a terrorist. What if you were to be targeted? Do they have the same right? Because that's an enemy combatant in those terms.
Well, no, because he is a civilian, and he's unequivocally a civilian. He's a civilian with he's civilian with military background, but he is a civilian. Look, we would have a problem, I think, if we took out the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, or if we took out President Rouhani of Iran. That would be a real problem. But to take out General Soleimani, especially when he is in the midst of directing terrorist operations, and you see, the point is, I don't know what the information that they disclosed to this meeting of the Congress today was, but there's no question, you don't have any doubt at all, that he was the one who directed the previous attack that claimed an American contractor and who directed the operations to storm our embassy and burn part of it down. This goes also to the kind of question. One of the things President Trump is determined not to do is no more Benghazis. You get the last word, Steve.
Well, what I'll say is, why not Raul Castro next? Why not any of them? He claims to be a military.
I think Raul Castro is retired. He's gone. Raul Castro doesn't run Cuba anymore. Look, I think taking heads of state is a real problem, and this is a point that a number of people have made. Professor Dershowitz made this point, is that we were talking about trying to take out Fidel Castro when he was the dictator of Cuba. And that was a very different situation than Operation Foxley, which was an operation that Churchill authorized, which was an attempt to take out Hitler during the war, in the middle of the war. And you're right, there we had a full-scale war. The problem with the attempts that people talked about, and there were CIA plans that were laid for trying to get rid of Castro. The one that I thought was interesting was they're going to use either a poisoned or an exploding cigar because they knew he loved cigars. They never did. But at least according to some theorists, the Cubans got wind of that. And some people believe, I think wrongly, that it was in response to that the Cubans and Soviets got involved in an attempt to take down Kennedy, which eventually succeeded. I don't believe that that is true, but I think your phone call and your objection is substantive and worth discussing, and thank you for calling. When we come back on the Medved Show, there's a real crisis with people dying and going to the hospital because of vaping. What are they vaping? No, it's not nicotine. They're vaping THC. They're vaping weed, marijuana. I will talk to Alex Berenson, who a year after his groundbreaking book has been published, about some of the very, very real threats that to our greatest nation on God's green earth.